This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. The most memorable interviews and listener calls from the week that was on Fight Back with Libby Znaimer. Welcome to the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Good afternoon. Happy Easter if you're celebrating. And welcome to the Sunday edition of the Best of Fight Back. More of what you want to hear from the week that was. Healthcare was a big focus of the Ford PC's latest Ontario budget delivered this past Tuesday. A third of the money spent in the record-breaking $214 billion budget is earmarked for healthcare initiatives, including a surprise $2 billion for home care and nearly $550 million to help Ontario residents get access to family doctors by increasing the number of family health teams. The news came just after we learned that 108 residency placements in family medicine have gone unfilled. So given all of the evidence that doctors are not keen on going into family practice, will money solve the problem? Libby asked this of our medical record panelists when they joined Fight Back on Wednesday. Dr. Amol Verma is a staff physician in general internal medicine at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. Dr. Malcolm Moore is a medical oncologist with the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. And Dr. Elisa Naiman is a family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto.
There is millions of people within the province who do not have access to primary care. And within Toronto, it's currently at 500,000 people. And that number will go up to 700,000 within 2 years. And really something needs to be done now about the crisis in primary care. And I think that this is really good and it looks really good, the headline. But on a day-to-day level, it's really not going to help the family doctor who's working now and who's questioning whether or not they should continue within their practice. The problem is it's very hard to get a team. So, like, there would be no way that in my office that we would be able to have a team and to hire people. There's this infrastructure of people and the process to apply. You have to sort of be part of a larger organization. So unless they were going to take family doctors and allow them to go and to move their location and set up a clinic that has this interprofessional team, that I think would be great. And I think it would really help a lot with the burden. But just saying that they're going to fund doesn't help the new teams without being able to somehow shift where the current family doctors are working into this team, I really don't think is very helpful right now.
And Dr. Moore, just a few days ago or a week ago, we learned that 108 residency placements went unfilled, presumably because people don't want to go into family medicine. And then we have this. So what are your thoughts on that?
You've just got to be careful when you look at data that you're getting an accurate reflection. One thing that has happened over the past few years because of this recognition of a shortage of primary care docs is they have been increasing the number of training positions in primary care, I think by about 5% a year. So this doesn't actually mean that there are less people training in primary care. It means actually there are more because they've opened up more slots. That said, I was this way, and I'm sure the other people were. When I went into medical school, I really had no idea what specialty I wanted to do, and I made that decision based on my experiences through the 4 years of medical school. And I suspect most medical students are like that. So it is concerning that based on the fact that people are coming in with an open mind and family medicine at the end of their training is not viewed as one of the specialties that people are moving to do. The students are seeing what they see in family practice and they're saying, you know what, that's not for me.
One of the things that I noticed when there was this talk of teams, they kind of enumerated the various specialties and professions involved, and they included nurse practitioners. But nothing that I saw involved getting nurse practitioners covered by OHIP. what would the process be? Would it just be the government saying, okay, we're covering nurse practitioner visits, or is it a more complicated thing than that?
My understanding, a little bit outside of my area for sure, but my understanding is it's a little complicated in the sense that it would involve thinking about what like a fee schedule or what a remuneration schedule for nurse practitioners would look like. And it's why in general there's they tend to operate under a salary hired by a specific healthcare organization that maybe is getting funding for patient care from other methods or you know, receiving care as part of a broader package of funding and then allocating some of that to the nurse practitioner. So in one sense, care delivered by nurse practitioners can be covered by OHIP in that patients aren't necessarily paying out of pocket for that care because it's coming from some other way of the you know, funding within our healthcare system. But they're not billing the OHIP insurance program directly.
Dr. Amal Verma, staff physician in general internal medicine at St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto. Dr. Malcolm Moore, medical oncologist with the Princess Margaret Cancer Center. And Dr. Elisa Naiman, family physician and founder and medical director of the Medical Station in Toronto. This is Zoomer Radio's Best to Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. A vocal opponent of the latest Ontario budget is opposition NDP leader Marit Stiles. She says the Ford PCs are spending a record amount of money while delivering nothing significant. She joined Fight Back on Thursday when Libby asked her why she doesn't think $2 billion for home care is a positive.
I think this is an increase, certainly from the 2023 budget. But I just want to point out, I mean, one of the things that happened in the last budget was the government allocated about $1 billion then, and then actually very little of that actually went out and delivered change. So I think, you know, we're happy to see investments there in home care. We are big fans of home care in the NDP, of course. We need to make sure that people can stay in their homes and stay well longer. But I think unless that money is actually getting out the door and getting to the caregivers who really need that who are the ones who are going to be providing the care, it's really just words in a document. And I think that's my biggest concern. This budget overall was the largest. I mean, this is the biggest spending budget we've seen. We've got a deficit now of $10 billion, which is extraordinary, the largest deficit in Ontario history. But what we're concerned about is that so little of this budget and this spending is actually going into directly helping people in the ways that we know people need support.
They have $550 million for Ontario health teams, which they say will help people. Now, I personally don't think that money, for instance, for those health teams is necessarily going to fix it in the midst of a shortage of doctors who don't want to go into that practice. But all the stakeholders, you talk to union people and they all say what we need is money, and now there's money. So where do you see the problem?
Well, I think the difference is a difference between spending and then investing with care. Right. And what we're seeing here, and I certainly am a big fan of these, you know, interdisciplinary health teams. That's definitely something we've advocated for. But like you said, I mean, one of the biggest dilemmas we have right now is the shortage of family physicians, primary care doctors. We have 2.3 million Ontarians right now without access to that. And unfortunately, as you said, a lot of our new doctors are not wanting to go into family medicine. And one of the major reasons that they cite and why people are actually leaving family medicine is because of the very large administrative burden on family physicians. The OMA, the Medical Association, estimates that family doctors are spending 19 hours a week, 40% of their time on paperwork. And so one of the things we were hoping we'd see in this budget was a real effort from the government to relieve that administrative burden.
There are certain procedures that have become much easier and quicker over time that get paid very highly, where procedures like talking to a patient for a long period of time do not get paid very well. And a lot of that has to do not with the government, but with the OMA and with other regulatory bodies.
I think they have conversations to have with their college, for example, and with the government about billing. I think that's a really important conversation that they're having. And absolutely, you know, again, I want to say we are big fans of that interdisciplinary team approach, which I want to say doctors generally are as well.
Yeah.
They are certainly seeming to appreciate that a lot more. I mean, I remember when I got started and was doing a lot of healthcare policy work like 20 years ago, this was something that a lot of family physicians weren't as open to at the time. That's really changed. They're looking for those opportunities to work with other healthcare professionals in a team environment. And what we're seeing, and the government's announcement is a start, but when you look at, you know, what they're aiming to, what, be, I think, connect with about 600,000 more people, that's great, but it's still only a drop in the bucket, and the bucket is very leaky right now. 2.3 million people currently without primary care. By 2026, that's going to get up to about 4 million, about a quarter of the population of Ontario. So we're getting some way towards addressing that, but not fast enough.
Ontario NDP leader Marit Stiles in conversation with Libby on Thursday. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up after the break, what can be learned from Baltimore's horrible bridge collapse? We discuss next.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Good isn't good enough. Make way for the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. The tragic bridge collapse in Baltimore has left 6 workers dead, while 2 other people were rescued quickly, with 1 in serious condition. Video of the event shows the cargo ship losing power a couple of times before ultimately crashing into the bridge, which immediately dismantled and fell into the water below. Here in Canada, experts are scrambling to reassure us that Canadian bridges are safe. While there is also the question of the impact of the Francis Scott Key bridge collapse on Canada's supply chains. The Port of Baltimore handles more automobile freight than any other U.S. port, more than 750,000 vehicles in 2022, according to port data, as well as container and bulk cargo ranging from sugar to coal. Joining Libby on Wednesday to discuss, Jim Bookbinder, a professor in the Department of Management Sciences and the director of the Waterloo Management of Integrated Manufacturing Systems Research Group at the University of Waterloo, and Rob Hanfield, Bank of America Professor of Supply Chain Management at North Carolina State University.
What I've heard is that the bridge itself was sound, but that the design of the bridge was such that, you know, the major pier was hit, and it was, you know, really the design of these bridges is such that you knock on a major pier and the whole thing is going to collapse. They're all very interdependent on each other. And this was really a freak accident. There are actually diverters around the bridge to prevent ships from running into it. The ship, in this case, lost propulsion. They lost control of the ship. And it happened to go in at an angle that just hit that pier and was not diverted. So it was a freak accident, if anything. And so I don't think the bridge itself was unsound.
Jim Bookbinder, what could the impacts be on our supply chain? We've just seen that more automobile freight goes through that port than any other.
Yes, that's true in the U.S. Baltimore is a major importer of cars from Japan, and some of the major car companies have distribution centers near there. I think the impact might be that at one end of the bridge, at the north end of the bridge, there are distribution centers from Amazon and BMW, and so, you know, there might be a secondary effect on Canada from the fact that now everything will take a little longer, but the traffic that was on its way to Baltimore, the container ships, they will be diverted to other ports like Norfolk, Virginia, Savannah, Georgia, maybe, and this will all be sorted out. But the travel times for the containers to reach their destinations will be longer than they would have been otherwise.
What about the impact on supply chains in the U.S., Rob?
Well, I think, you know, one of the biggest exports from that port is coal. So certainly a lot of those coal shipments will have to be diverted to other bulk cargo ports, for instance, Port of Virginia, Norfolk, Port of New York, New Jersey, but also Port of Wilmington handles a lot of bulk cargo in North Carolina. The vehicles, what they call the ro-ro shipments, roll on, roll off, those will have to be diverted to other ports that handle that kind of freight. It's a very specific way of handling that particular type of freight, so it may likely have to go to Charleston or Virginia as well. So we're going to see increased capacity usage at other ports. We don't anticipate major diversions, as Dr. Bookbinder said. Certainly some delays may be inevitable, but nothing that is earth-shattering, I think, in the short term at least.
And during the pandemic, we saw shortages of autos, new cars, and they've just started to ease. So is there going to be any impact there, Dr. Bookbinder?
Perhaps not, because I think the automakers have built up the inventory of vehicles at their dealership. So it's a little better than it was at the low point of the pandemic. So no, I don't expect a big impact of that.
Jim Bookbinder, professor in the Department of Management Sciences and director of the Waterloo Management of Integrated Manufacturing Systems Research Group at the University of Waterloo, and Rob Hanfield, Bank of America professor of supply chain management at North Carolina State University. This is Zoomer Radio's Best of Fight Back. I'm Jane Brown. On Wednesday, the CAA kicked off its annual Worst Roads campaign, where residents get to vote on which roads they feel are the worst, whether you are a driver, cyclist, or pedestrian. According to the Canadian Automobile Association, damage to vehicles from potholes can range from $500 to more than $2,000, with the average cost of repairs being as high as $850. As the campaign got underway, Libby spoke with Teresa DeFelice, Assistant Vice President of Government and Community Relations for CAA South Central Ontario.
Steeles, for many, many years, was on the list and then finally came off the list when all of the municipalities involved, because Steeles is a very long major arterial throughout the GTA, and all the municipalities were having a bit of a conversation, and Steeles was wrapped up in it, and it finally got fixed. But, you know, the surface does have a road lifespan. And so, you know, now it's starting to show a little bit of its wear and tear again, and it's popping back up on the list. So, you know, it does happen from time to time that roads that have come off the list come back on. And some of these other ones are really connected to major transit infrastructure projects, right? So you feel everything. You feel not just what the construction and the congestion pain, but it's also the fact that the road's getting pretty beat up as a lot of vehicles are heading through there with materials.
Now, Dufferin was for many years at the top of the list, and I don't see it there last year. What's the story on Dufferin?
Yeah, Dufferin, again, was one of those ones that was put on the list, and many years ago, after it kept appearing on the list and a new mayor was elected in Toronto, they actually expedited the fixes on Dufferin Street in order to get it done. And, you know, I also travel Dufferin Street, and so in some parts we're starting to see that wear and tear again. So it'll be interesting to see if people start bringing that one back into the conversation.
How does potholes and the problems created by potholes play into all this construction that seems to always be happening all at once?
Sure. Sure. I mean, what happens with that is, you know, obviously when a construction project is going on, they're not going to go and repave the road in the middle of that construction project. And sometimes those roads have to take a little longer. So, for instance, Eglinton Avenue East has come off the list, and it was on for a large duration when the majority of that transit project was really in that eastern portion. It's really the west section now that's still ongoing. But even in that time, like residents are saying is, okay, we get there's construction. Yeah, they may be voting on it, voting it forward because they want to see it on the list. But the city actually then did go fill in some potholes and try and make it a little bit better than it was. And so that is one of the challenges that people face. But the other thing to note about the CAA Worst Roads campaign is when you go to CAAWorstRoads.com to nominate, you can nominate one road, more than one road. You have the option, whether you are a cyclist, a pedestrian, a driver. Predominantly, people tell us it's about the road surface, but then we also hear complaints about congestion or lack of infrastructure like cycling or sidewalks or cycling paths. So, you know, it really is open to whatever your pain point. If it's bad signage, poor traffic light timing, congestion, that is a bad road. If that's a bad road to you, it's causing you pain, then, you know, let us help you take your voice to government.
And I've always had questions about repeat closures because Bathurst gets a lot of construction repeatedly, and it's very hard to know what is going on. Also, DuPont.
Yeah, I think that has to do with the infrastructure underground. And so, you know, that's a big project too. The sewer ones are like sewers take up a lot of space, and so you know, they're big round drums that have to be excavated, and so that I believe that project is a sewer main project.
Teresa DeFelice, Assistant Vice President, Government and Community Relations for CAA South Central Ontario. You're listening to the best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. I'm Jane Brown. Coming up, what you had to say about the week that was and the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Zoomer Radio, pulling no punches with the best of Fight Back with Jane Brown.
Fight Back with Libby Znaimer has the most informed guests on the week's hot topics, and we also rely on you for your valued opinions. Here are some of this week's best calls. Susan in Toronto phoned about a firsthand experience with a public health clinic.
I had some elderly parents, and there was a nurse practitioner-led clinic that opened up a couple of years prior. So I called them up, and they were taking new patients, and I signed my parents on, totally covered by OHIP. So my mother now, you know, gets home visits by them because she's now 90 and she has Alzheimer's. And they have a dietitian in that nurse practitioner-led clinic. They have social worker. And everything is covered by OHIP.
Merrick called from Toronto's High Park neighborhood during our segment on the CAA's worst roads.
I'm riding my bicycle. It's not safe. Because when the people are opening the door or coming out between the cars, you don't see them. So this is my proposal, is that let's get back to the blue street. The street should be street. And the bicycles, I don't use the city of Toronto, probably are not riding bicycles. You're going to work.
Siham in Toronto also called in on this topic.
I live on Lakeshore and Royal York on the south side, and we have two bike lanes, the lane for the cars and the streetcar or the bus. And it is a very, very dangerous thing to come out of a driveway and try to cross about four different lanes between pedestrians, cyclists, cars, and streetcar and bus.
And now, Fight Back's Knockout Call of the Week.
There were a lot of great calls this week, but the winner of the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week is Jane in Toronto, another one, who says suddenly Bloor West has become congested when it was fine before unused bike lanes were installed.
It's the bike lanes that are perpetually causing a traffic jam from Royal York on. And, you know, I haven't seen one bike today go by there. I live on Bloor Street in a condominium, and it's insane. It's traffic, traffic, traffic.
That does it for this week's Best of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. If you'd like to qualify for the Fight Back Knockout Call of the Week, phone us noon to one weekdays. Or if you have a comment, email us at fightback@zoomer.ca. Follow us on X at FightbackLibby and call our Fight Back voicemail anytime at 416-367-9636. I'm Jane Brown. Join me again next weekend when we'll round up the best of Fight Back.
Best of Fight Back is produced by Jane Brown, Ziv Hadi, and Dan Christakos. Technical production by Ian Robertson. Executive producer, Moses Neimer. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.